Hello and welcome to Building Your T-Shirt Empire. My name's Cole and with me, as always, is Gavin. Let's jump right into the news.
Have you seen all the news about this new Barbie movie? It's everywhere. Now, with this new Barbie movie coming out, big brands, they're taking advantage. For example, the big retail store, The Gap, they just launched a line of super pink Barbie clothing. And it's not just in the fashion industry either. The musician Billie Eilish just launched her own Barbie merchandise. There's even a beverage company that launched a new flavor, and they're calling it the Barbie Pink Lemonade. How cool is that? Now think about it. You could do the same thing too. Pink t-shirts, pink hoodies, pink promos, pink accessories, all with the pink Barbie vibe. Remember, if the big brands can do it, you could do it too. Because it ain't their world, it's a Barbie world. Hey, did you know the custom t-shirt printing market has an estimated worth of $10.3 billion? So here's the main thing that's driving this. Number one, there's a huge demand for retail-ready custom apparel. And two, fashion trends happen on a seasonal basis. So if you are in a t-shirt printing industry or you own a t-shirt printing company, you are in a good spot.
Have you heard about the crazy new pricing for the Yves Saint Laurent collection with Nirvana? They are super expensive. YSL is now selling special Nirvana t-shirts, some of which are costing $4,000. Why are they so expensive? Well, these t-shirts are vintage, and that means they're very old and very hard to find. Most of them being made in the 90s in limited edition for specific events. YSL says that makes them special, just like a rare painting. So if you're a big fan of Nirvana or vintage t-shirts, maybe this is an exciting opportunity for you.
There's a company that's called ProColor. They just launched a DTF printer for less than $1,000. Less than $1,000 for a DTF printer. Think about this. You now could offer unlimited colors, take on job that you couldn't take on before, and serve your customers faster. Is the screen printing profession in trouble?
This week we have a very exciting guest. It's Cole Pinder, who is the founder of OC3PL, which is a shipping fulfillment company. So Cole, give us kind of a quick rundown of what the company's doing day to day right now.
Yeah, certainly. So we're an e-commerce fulfillment company, so an alternative to something like an Amazon. So we focus on apparel, cosmetics, other small items. We have some beverage clients, but strictly focused on e-commerce fulfillment.
And I mean, being e-commerce fulfillment, how in the world do you manage that? Because I feel like every small business on the planet has to deal with shipping something at some point. Mm-hmm. And how did you build that up from just, hey, let me take your crap to the post office, to what is now a large facility with a full staff? Like, yeah. What was that differentiator and what was that journey like?
Yeah, certainly. And actually, I used to take packages to the post office when we first got started, and even to like FedEx. My background is in freight, so LTL, which is less than truckload. So I worked for a big publicly traded company for 7-8 years and learned the larger shipments, that space in the freight world. And ignorantly, I thought, well, I can do this better than working for a big corporation. I'm a speedboat, not a cruise ship.
Classic.
And yeah, exactly. And so I started a freight brokerage first and foremost, where we focused on helping businesses ship freight orders, point A to point B. And it's kind of a funny story. I got the fulfillment business started out of that because I was sitting at a folding table in my buddy Greg's warehouse in Southern California here. I'm like, man, he has a lot of space in here and it's empty. And I think I could store people's stuff and make some money. So we had two freight customers that used the same 3PL, which is a third party fulfillment group. So they're not the buyer of the goods or the seller of the goods. They just store the inventory and ship the orders, which is ultimately what we do. And we could never get freight picked up on time. So I said to those two customers, hey, if I could store and ship your stuff, could I be your fulfillment partner? And one was like, yes, but you need a website. Our board of directors isn't going to approve using a vendor who doesn't even have a website.
Right.
And you need a warehouse management software that we can access to see our inventory. So I just Googled, you know, WMS system, found a provider, and built a domain name. And I just got so many inbound requests for fulfillment services. I'm like, I don't feel like picking up the phone and trying to convince people to save $15 on a freight shipment anymore. I would rather just lean into all these incoming requests. And so that's how I got started. Had to figure out the parcel shipping side of things because I understood freight and freight contracts, but had to learn parcel business and all the different carriers that were servicing that size package and just kind of learn it by doing. So,
and so how many years ago was that?
That was the end of, well, actually early 2018.
Okay. So really not that long that you've built it up. How many buildings have you had to switch over to now?
We have moved at least once per year up until last year.
Oh,
so we would basically double square footage every year.
How do you get out of leases like that? Or are you telling people you want a 1 year lease to begin with?
There's a lot of interesting things that happened getting us from one building to the next, but we did a lot of subleasing of spaces that had shorter maturities. And then with what happened during the pandemic, rates were rising so much that our landlords were willing to let us out of the leases because they knew they could capture a higher rent.
That's good.
So just fortunate timing, and then some subleasing is really what allowed us to do that.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the e-commerce system, I mean, the way we do it is someone places an order on Shopify, it comes into, we use Shipping Easy, and then we see a giant batch of orders for the day, we pull it off the shelf, and, you know, someone's just kind of in charge of hopefully not screwing up the packing. On your level, what does that look like, and how do you scale and train those staff? Because I'm assuming you're doing thousands of units. How do you scale that assembly line for picking and packing?
Well, it didn't happen overnight. That was really the crux of our business, was figuring out how to make every little step a process. So from the time it comes into our warehouse, so being an apparel fulfillment business, a lot of screen printers are delivering their goods to us. So nailing down a process through our software, our WMS software. So if like a Shipping Easy or a ShipStation has some of these, you know, fundamental processes built in, but they're pretty rudimentary. So a full-scale WMS will have pretty thorough options for you. So we built a receiving process to check goods in, to make sure it's accurate, then put away into the locations from which we'll pick, and then basically programming the algorithm within that WMS to help our team pick it and pack it properly. So it sounds easy, right? Oh, I'm going to go to these four bins and pick those shirts and put those in a package and slap a shipping label on it. But it's really a lot more complicated than that. So I'll try to give you the short version, but basically we want to pick up and down one aisle or go up and down and pass through a location only once. So it's serpentine pick pattern. It's all just algorithms that are native to the warehouse management system. And we use tablets that affix to our carts. And all of our like material handling equipment is set up to do apparel fulfillment. So they're walking their carts and following the prompts on a screen, go to this location, pick this number of units, place it in this bin. And by the time they've gone and passed through all the locations, they've picked, you know, 12 to 24 orders, depending on how big the orders are. So they're scanning. All of our items are barcoded. So they're scanning all the items, validating the pick. And then it gets to the packing station where we have a second scan to validate all the contents of the order. That's how we make sure we're shipping the orders accurately. So they're passing them in front of a scanner, placing them on a scale. That's capturing the weight. We're scanning the package type. That tells our system the dimensions. So it takes those two pieces of information and shops the most appropriate carrier for what the customer's selected.
Interesting.
And then outspits a packing list and a shipping label. And then on our screen, we have pop-ups if there's any special requirements, like, hey, insert a first-time order, mailer. So, and then our packers follow that process and toss them in a bin where they get sorted and routed to the correct carrier.
Huh. So tell me more about the correct carrier thing, because we're always doing it as, you know, just everything leaves USPS first class or everything leaves parcel or whatever.
Yep.
How do you calculate the different carriers and connect that within your system?
So we will have contracts with a ton of parcel carriers, and that really is dictated by what our account manager and our director of brand success will set up with the brand. So we give the brands all the options. Hey, what do you want to offer to your customers at checkout? Is there a free shipping threshold you want to use? Do you want a two-day carrier? What are you looking to offer to your customers? And then that instruction that comes through from like a Shopify, will map to a service or a set of services we have in our WMS, again, the warehouse management system. And then we can eliminate certain options, like let's say we don't want to consider first class mail or some other slower shipping service. We'll remove that from the available options for whatever that customer selected at checkout. And then our system will rate shop it, because again, we're providing accurate weights and dimensions. And through the back end, that'll rate shop and choose the most affordable option that meets that criteria for the customer. So that's all set up on the initial onboarding with the brands. Say, what do you want to offer to your end consumer?
So then how do you manage, and this is mostly my wife's fault, I'm assuming, because what I see her do is buy 5 items and return 4.
Yeah.
How do you manage the additional cost in that return label, creating the label ahead of time so that it's in the package without actually paying for it? How do you manage that whole return process once the initial shipment leaves?
Well, that's really at our brand's direction.
Okay.
So we can give them some guidance. Like, I think there's some studies out there that would probably suggest that if you make it too easy to return stuff, customers will. But most of our brands come to us with a return strategy already in mind. Like, they want to use a Returnly or a Loop Returns, and they manage that outside of our WMS. So they pretty much tell us what they want to do, and then we incorporate that into our process. So if they want a return label printed at the time that their shipping label is printed, we can provide that. Or they can use a third-party app like a Returnly or a Loop. And those can integrate back into our WMS through some third-party apps.
Got it. So with these customers, it seems like your best customers are all like successful businesses. Like, someone's not going to come to you wanting you to fulfill 100 items. So how in the world are you getting these contacts to trust you and do something with you besides maybe one of the massive corporations that is already set up to do it?
Well, that's a big question. We do actually fulfill for some pretty small brands. If it's the right profile for us, we'll work with them, especially if we see some pretty big opportunities. Like, they've got a good plan, they've got a brand that's growing and catching steam. We've helped a lot of brands transition from the garage to, you know, working in a 3PL environment. I think that's kind of what sets us apart.
Okay.
So really, we've got a phenomenal staff. You've met Madison, where she helps really work as an educator with these brands about, hey, this is what it looks like to be successful in a 3PL environment. And then we're just flexible. Like, Maddie's educated enough, and our team's educated enough about what makes a successful e-commerce apparel brand. And so she can help educate them on being successful in the 3PL environment. So a lot of it is just being consultative and, you know, working as a team with them and trying to be an extension of their brand. But yeah, most of the brands that come to us are established or are very well on their way to being established. And then a lot of our new clients come from referrals, you know, trying to just absolutely crush it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you know, you probably don't know which one I'm referring to. But I'm curious, how big is your operation right now in terms of people? Like, how many people are you managing right now?
We have right now about 55 team members. And during our peak season, which is, you know, just before Black Friday, Cyber Monday, we can fluctuate up to like 130. Kind of just depends on what our customers are projecting from order volume and you know, what's coming inbound to us to be processed to ship. So,
gotcha. So the second part of that is, I see a lot of screen printing shop owners, because a lot of us, we start at home or in a garage, right? We start small, and folks like Cole Lumstrom will make it to the next level. But there's a lot of shops that get stuck in that growth or that small stage. It seems like you've been able to kind of crack that with your business. What have you done, or what was the playbook that you followed to help you get to that point?
I think largely luck, being in the right place at the right time and saying yes to the opportunities that came in front of us, really is, I mean, boil it down to that, you know, having the right people on our staff and trusting them, but then also just where we're located in Southern California, we're near a lot of screen print shops and a lot of brands that are in the streetwear space. And so just being close to the where garments are being produced and where brands live, it was huge. And then just being willing to say yes. So definitely staff, definitely the right place and the right time. We really benefited with COVID. You know, everybody got comfortable ordering from home. So our brands that we were already working with were growing like crazy, which provided us a platform to grow from.
Gotcha.
With having 55 plus employees at a time, what is your like hierarchy and business structure? Because obviously you're not going to be walking around the shop telling everyone what to do. And how did you, since you've only been doing it for 5 years, how did you make those key hires that you could give them enough independence to succeed and, you know, not potentially find out huge problems after the fact?
Well, trial and error. So we've certainly made our fair share of mistakes hiring-wise. That's been really challenging. I mean, it's the biggest challenge, I think, of growing a business from one stage to another. And for me, you know, back in the day when we had 6-7 people, if we got a huge influx of orders, like, oh, cool, well, I'll just go out there and I'll just work harder, longer hours and just make it happen. And then growing to the next level of being able to say, okay, I can't just do it all anymore. I need the right people. And to give up control has been really hard. So finding the right people is certainly just largely off gut, you know, whether it's folks that were working for us that, you know, new hires that went temp to hire and seeing, oh, these people have drive and motivation and they love what they do and they have a good personality. Okay, let's give them some more responsibility and some more responsibility. Certainly have made mistakes in that. But then also like Madison, who heads up director of brand success for us, she was at Verizon and helping me with phone plans for our team and said, hey, what are you going to do after this role? Like saw the talent, recent college graduate, loved her personality, work ethic, and we just poached her and stole her. so really I've just trusted my gut and, you know, it hasn't always been the right decision, but you kind of just learn over time and we have a lot of turnover.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just a craft that you curate over time just by doing.
I mean, being in Orange County, and we've definitely hired our share of, like, you know, the people at the end of the dryer or the people that help bag. And you always in your mind think, well, this is like a minimum wage job until you hire a bad person. And you're like, I will gladly pay more for someone who doesn't just do massively badly at the job. So what is your tactic for those kind of like low level labor, but you need the productivity and you need like the reliability?
So up until recently, a lot of that was just gut feel. And, you know, everybody wants to have like a small, like family feel at their business. And that gets harder as you add more people. But really, it's about having the right managers that treat the team with respect and flexibility and kindness. And we can always be doing a better job about curating a good workplace. But really, it's just recognizing the folks that aren't going to be a good fit early and getting them out because it's so much about attitude and fit. And our managers and supervisors really understand what we're looking for and will kind of just, you know, pull the plug like, I'm not really sure this person's a good fit for us. But we have a really good staffing agency that helps us vet, bring in people to start as temps that we will transition to, you know, full-time team members after an introductory period. So we've honed that relationship over years. So they know exactly what we're looking for, who would be a good fit. So they do a lot of that work for us.
Oh, okay.
I mean, there's we pay a premium for it.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it works better for our business. And we do have a lot of turn. I mean, there's a lot of warehousing jobs in this area. So we pay a little bit higher than the market. And we're quick to give raises for the folks that we can tell are going to be a good fit for us. And then up until recently, we hired a director of operations who's introduced a lot of metrics for us. A lot of it, you know, growing so fast has just been gut feel. I think we're doing a good job. I think that person picks enough orders per hour. And hiring the director of operations who can get into the metrics, set some standards. We call it units per hour as a metric that we track, and we want to see people progressing to what we know is a normalized amount of units per hour. So that's more recent for us, and we're still learning how to manage through the metrics.
And so speaking of metrics, I'd love to hear about what you've either already implemented or what you'd love to figure out how to implement as far as automation, because ultimately your number one competitor would be like an Amazon warehouse. And so how do you even keep up with that level of robotics, automation, and also just from what I understand, a ridiculously high pick count that they demand out of their mm-hmm. customers. Mm-hmm. How do you do that without, you know, depleting all your capital and yeah. also having some sort of healthy margin?
Truthfully, I'm not an expert in that space. And when we get to a building large enough to where robotics might make sense economically, where there mm-hmm. might be a return on the investment, I'll start educating myself on that. But I've heard, you know, it's challenging. It's a big capital investment. And certainly there's returns there. Otherwise, folks wouldn't be doing it. I'm just not super educated on that yet. But as we grow, that will certainly come into the mix. Right now, you know, we know where our margins need to be based on those units per hour. And also we can kind of tell just from order count. And we've just focused on being more efficient operationally, using good material handling equipment, having good processes. But certainly there'll be a point where hopefully we land one of these e-commerce darlings that's doing 15,000 to 20,000 orders a day where automation will, you know, become viable.
So tell everybody, you know, I would assume most listeners are probably on the small business in spectrum, but I know some people also work within larger facilities and they're just, you know, maybe a manager or something. Mm-hmm. Tell them kind of the expected rates on the shipping, but then also your fees. And what that looks like maybe at, you know, one or two different obvious price breaks.
Yeah, so our entry-level pricing would start around 100 orders a day.
Okay.
Anything less than that, it gets hard to be efficient. You know, we can fulfill 4 or 5 orders a day, but it's not going to be efficient for us. We're going to have to do the same pick path that we would for 24 orders, right? So in that scenario, we try to be somewhere like $2.50 to $3 an order. And as customers start to ship in considerable volumes, like 2,000 orders a day, then we can get pretty aggressive and fulfill an order for less than $2.
Okay.
But it sort of depends on the customer's product mix. You know, picking a case of an energy drink is far different from picking a t-shirt or a sticker. So we know based on product size and weights and then what we can yield on the carrier markup, where to price the fulfillment services. So with regards to carriers, it's all about what the brand is trying to achieve. Do they want to offer free shipping when they hit a certain threshold and offer a fast delivery experience? Or can the customer wait 5 to 7 days and leverage a consolidator or somebody that handles a majority of the transit and delivers to the post office nearest where the consumer lives and save on the shipping and on the postage? In exchange for slower transit time. So it just depends on what the brand's looking for. We can provide savings 10 to 15% lower than what's like publicly available through some of these platforms like you might be using in Shipping Easy or mm-hmm. ShipStation or what's available natively on Shopify. But it just depends on what the brand's looking for.
Hmm. And so, you know, when somebody's doing 100 a day, what would they be expecting to be their all-in price for, you know, a 2-day label with a pick and pack? Are they looking at $8, $9 or what are they thinking? What would be kind of reasonable if they were shopping around?
It totally depends on the product mix because, you know, using the example of like a 12-pack energy drink.
Right.
2-day shipping on that to New York from California is going to be really expensive. Somebody shipping with like a priority mail or a FedEx 2-day with a t-shirt is going to be considerably less expensive. So it really depends. I don't want to give numbers yeah. and have people think, gosh, I'm really overpaying when they might not be. So that's really that's the largest line item for all of our clients is their shipping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pick pack charges could be, you know, a quarter to a half of what the shipping label is going to cost. So understanding the customer's product mix, how they want to present their packaging, all of that is factored into what shipping options they should offer at checkout. And ultimately it ends with what's the experience they want their end consumer to have. Do they want to open up a roll tuck top box and be presented with their sweatshirt in a certain way with a couple stickers and some other promotional item? Well, that box is gonna change the dimensions of the overall package that they're receiving, which is gonna change the pricing.
Right.
So it all starts with what do you want your end consumer to experience when they receive their product? And then we back into the options that's available for our brands.
Yeah, absolutely. Gavin, you were saying?
So a lot of the folks that's listening here are t-shirt printers or screen printers, right? So your company serve? I'm curious to know, like, what size, because there's a huge range of size. You, like, right now at Cole's shop, you could see his shop, right? Like, what's the ideal customer that should even try to reach out to you or even try to use your service?
Well, I would say screen print shops that are taking on jobs that the fulfillment aspect might be overwhelming, we might be a good fit for. So whether it's too large of a quantity or complexity and SKU range, so maybe they're doing three long sleeve tees, two hoodies, and three or four tees in various colorways and sizes extra small through 3X, that might be a little bit overwhelming, especially if the end customers are ordering two, three pieces. And I'm speaking more in like a drop basis or a pre-order for an artist, musician, something along, you know, influencer, something along those lines. That would be a perfect fit for us because we're going to be able to produce the high volume quickly, you know, get thousands of orders out per day, handle the complexity of multiple SKUs, and then offer the really aggressive shipping rates. Specifically in those drop scenarios or pre-order scenarios, the customer knows they're not going to get their package in 2 to 3 days. We can leverage some of our more affordable carrier options. And actually in those scenarios, a lot of times our fulfillment fees are actually, you know, covered by the savings that we provide in the shipping. So for the screen print shop, it can just be a tool to be able to say yes to those projects and know the orders are going to go out accurately, timely, and, you know, cost effectively.
We recently did a job where our customer took it to a different 3PL, and the problem was their onboarding of the product felt very slow, and it was a topical release. So because this one person was in the news, they were trying to capitalize on it. And then even though we turned the job in, I think, like 72 hours from when we first were talking about it, the 3PL, like, added an entire week before they were shipping, and we were just like, what's going on? And they basically acted like there was no other option. So what is your onboarding of a completely new design look like, and what would people expect time-wise?
Yeah, so that's where we're different. Madison and our account management team, they understand what's required working with the screen shop, print shop, to be able to turn that around quickly. Is it going to be bagged? Is it going to be barcoded? When are you going to deliver it? Because if the answer is yes to those first two questions, yeah, we'll deliver it bagged and barcoded, then we are going to turn it around immediately. We're going to know when it's coming in and be able to quickly receive it, check it in, put it away into the pick bins, and turn around and process it. Depending on how many orders, could be same day or next day. A realistic turnaround would be about 48 hours to make sure we have enough time to check it in properly, make sure we're not missing a carton from the screen print shop, which has happened. But if you don't have that, then you just got to communicate with our team. Hey, it's not, we can't deliver it bagged and barcoded. We don't have those capabilities. That way we can plan labor accordingly on our end to say, okay, we need X number of people to be prepared to bag it and barcode it.
Do you do that in-house?
Yeah. Yep.
Do you have a folding line, or are you actually doing it old school?
Old school. Just because we don't do it every single day.
Yeah.
Most of our clients are also shipping some element of our retail, you know, so they have everything barcoded when it comes in.
Got it.
And so, but we can turn around and do it. And part of that onboarding setup that you're talking about is before the drop happens, we want to be working with the screen print shop to say, hey, let us help get this ready to be inducted into the 3PL environment so we can turn it around quickly. Meaning those listings on Shopify, let's make sure we have unique barcode values. They don't have to be UPCs, but unique SKU values that are help us check it in. And we can even provide the barcodes to the screen print shop if we collect that information ahead of time. It's easy enough for us to print the correct quantity and mail them out to the screen print shop so that either they can barcode them or we can do it when it comes to us. It just depends.
So you are in California. Say a screen print shop is in New York, right? I'm trying to walk through the process in my head. What would that be like? So I'm interested in this thing that you're talking about. And what do I do? What do you do? Like, how does the pickup happen? I'm still trying to put all that together in my head.
Yeah. So we have a facility in Peoria, Illinois. So we would probably route a New York screen print company to our Illinois facility. and in 2024 we'll be in Texas. But right now what we would do is get a feel for the scope of the project. How many garments are we talking? Are we talking 4 pallets, 6 pallets, 24 pallets? What does that look like? And then our freight company will route it to our facility to turn around and process it. In fact, we had one brand based in Manhattan where it was still faster to freight the product to our warehouse in California to turn around and fulfill about 5,000 orders than it was for them to send it to their partner in New York, for them to bag it, barcode it, and then turn around and fulfill all those orders. They just didn't have the capacity or scale to be able to do it.
Gotcha.
And so, like, looking at it, I know that some of the big guys in our industry, when they're talking about fulfillment, they're looking at building out basically a two-day ship to anywhere in the country without having to buy two-day labels. Mm-hmm. So they're talking about, you know, northeast, southeast, somewhere in the middle of the country, maybe to West Coast. What is kind of your grand vision? And also, how are you planning on doing that? Does that mean, you know, new investors? Does it mean crazy loans? Like, what is kind of your 3 to 4 year path?
Yeah. Well, so the way we would handle that today is we have a partner in North Carolina. So if somebody was dead set on splitting their inventory, which isn't always the easiest thing to do, to project exactly how much you're going to need in which location. I mean, that's a significant inventory investment for the brands. Mm-hmm. But we partner with a facility in North Carolina that would handle East Coast. We can handle Central, Midwest out of Peoria, and then certainly us out here in the West Coast. But as we look to the future, I'm debt averse. I don't know that we would use loans, but we're opening up in Texas in March of 2024 with an anchor account. We'll be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And we'll basically, it's a great loyal customer of ours that wants to be there. Their customer base is there. It's a natural progression for their business. And for us as a fulfillment company focused in e-commerce to have a centralized location like Texas. So we'll get space pretty significantly larger than what that client needs, and focus on filling that location. Mm-hmm. That way we have bi-coastal in that we'll be in California and Texas, and eventually tri-coastal. Maybe in 2026, we would open a facility on the East Coast so that we could hit the three coasts.
If you're going to be in Fort Worth, you got to hit up Brett at Printed Threads if you don't know him yet.
I don't, but I'd love to know him.
Brett has I don't know what it's at now, $4 million plus shop. He's like the Fort Worth printer. So
sweet.
Definitely get a hold of him. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned, so you're debt adverse. I'm curious, like, have you seeked out investors to build this company? What's been your startup building path?
Yeah. I'm debt adverse. I'm from the Midwest. Pretty conservative. Okay. You know, just how I was raised, I'm debt averse. Some people might not think that's smart, right? Leverage debt where it can be leveraged. But I've just kind of always lived with, I don't want to pay or owe anybody anything. So it's been bootstrapped. So the first 2 years of the company was literally get out there and pack the packages myself, work a lot of hours. Thankfully, I had still have a very supportive girlfriend who didn't ask anything of me, just supported me through that grind time. So just bootstrapped it and then rolled the dice and said, okay, we're going to take on 10,000 square feet and I'm going to sign $500,000 lease and just figure a way to fill it and pay the bills. And then, okay, now we're going to go into 20,000 square feet, sign $1 million lease and just figure out how we're going to bring in clients and fill it and pay the bills and just have always bootstrapped it. And then once you reach a certain scale, it gets a little bit easier to grow to the next stage. Just because you have you're a little bit more established and a little bit more consistent revenue. So
yeah,
that's how we've done it.
Having all that control right now, I mean, would you entertain somebody who just wanted to throw cash at you as a partner, or are you just kind of like, you know, you're doing perfectly fine for yourself, and so you don't really want the the new person taking any control?
I've given a lot of thought to that, and up until very recently, I was interested in doing that. And then just kind of what we're seeing overall in the economy, I'm a little bit hesitant. So I'm kind of pulling back a little bit. I think I could deploy capital in additional facilities and in some other key areas of the business. But for right now, it's not maybe so much complacency, but we want to just see what happens in the next 6 to 12 months. I mean, we are expanding into Texas. But I don't like having a boss.
Right.
even if it's just a capital partner, I don't want to have to answer to anybody. I had a business partner actually when I first started my freight brokerage, and I wanted to go fast, make quick decisions, trust my gut. He had a wife and two young kids, and
the worst
was yeah.
What a loser!
What's he doing? Offspring. No, so you know, and like it was hard for me to slow down and
right.
and to have to have somebody else also like convince somebody to make a decision. I felt like it was just distracting and got in the way from you know what, we might not have the perfect plan today, but we'll figure it out. So I'm really hesitant to have partners. So I'm sure there'll come a time when going to the next level may require raising some capital, and I'm not opposed to that. I've never done it, so it'll be a fun learning experience, but not in the immediate future.
I noticed you guys was featured in a article recently, DC Velocity. So congrats on that. How was that like? How do you get the word out? How do you get your company featured on these publications? What do you do?
I'll be honest with you. I don't even know what that is.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Okay. You know what? I've done a couple interviews with through some of our partners, like our staffing agency and a logistics partner, and they've done some interviews behind the scenes. You know, I didn't know where it was going to show up. Okay. But,
I think it's on the internet.
Perfect. Well, no, I think it's just been, we have really strong relationships with the key vendors that help us be successful, specifically some of our carriers and our staffing agency, where, you know, we're pretty hands-on with what we need from them. And I like to think we're helping them build a better business by demanding certain things. And it goes two ways when they say, hey, like, we have a strong partnership. Can we interview you and talk about what's worked? And so that it's probably the result of one of those conversations. But I think actually, to answer your question, being open and having good, deep relationships with the vendors that have made us successful is really the how we've gotten into outlets like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm interested, and Gavin can probably relate with this more, but have you gotten into it all trying to develop your own software solutions? And what does that look like other than a giant money pit?
You know, I like the idea of that. I would love to try to build our own WMS. But at the end of the day, I'm not an expert in development. I don't have any development experts on my team. We don't have that earmarked in our budget today. And I'm of the mindset that we find really good partners that do really well in their specific fields and lean into those relationships and learn from what they have available. Like, our largest carrier partner was a connection through our WMS provider. So they were the ones that said, hey, have you considered this for your business? And I hadn't. And so I just lean on that more than trying to do it in-house. We've talked in the past. We've tried to, you know, branch out a little bit and, you know, deviate from what we do really well, and it ended up being a waste of time and energy and resources. So I don't think that's in our future. Perhaps maybe sometime down the line in the perfect world, if we're able to maybe grow through an acquisition on the East Coast that maybe has their own WMS software that they've built in-house and we can roll that out to additional facilities, that would be something where I could see us, you know, doing something like building our own software, but probably not from scratch. We just don't have the expertise or the line item in our budget to do that.
And so with your business talking about doing what you're good at, you know, the thing that I always wish existed was basically a network of small businesses similar to the way that like Custom Ink is structured. So if somebody is creating a product for, you know, a customer in Florida, and there's 300 units due at the Greek in L.A., it doesn't really make sense for that Florida person to keep the order. And if they were a part of a network, that network could just be utilized. Maybe you have some sort of lead commission, but you could have like a national network that isn't necessarily a brand that's controlled by 4imprint or Custom Ink or whatever. Do you see any sort of opportunities there with some of the major screen printers you've been working with to either create your own kind of systemized network, or maybe even just start that as almost kind of like a community system that maybe has reviews or ratings?
Absolutely. I think if someone had the bandwidth to tackle that, there would be a huge opportunity to link local 3PL providers and local screen shops to work in tandem to service folks like that. 100% there would be a huge opportunity to do that. What our team has been talking about internally is what we know how to do really well is fulfillment, and we know how to set up the fulfillment centers fast because we've moved so many times in a short period of time. I think an opportunity exists to say, hey, if you have a screen print shop with a significant footprint, a big warehouse, and you want to start doing fulfillment, my team conceivably could say, well, here's the software we use, backfill it with carrier rates, backfill it with pricing agreements, and help get a screen print shop set up to be a fulfillment center that ultimately we could leverage. So in theory, we could yield on every single parcel shipped by that 3PL and still provide them rates that better than they could achieve on their own. And we could help them get set up. Hey, we already know the processes. We know how to price it. We know how to invoice it. We kind of have 3PL in a box. So I've thought about that, having bandwidth to do so. Not sure I have it today, but certainly in the future would love to explore that more.
Yeah, I mean, talking to some of the guys I know who have been successful with growing their print shop, they like printing a lot more than they like shipping. Mm-hmm. But then they also do this kind of all-in-one thing where they're doing an okay job of fulfillment in-house, and it's driving them crazy. So having you essentially use their space but teach them how to do it properly, or even staff it for them, you know, like remotely manage, that would be an insane opportunity, I think. Because so many people want that off their plate.
We have, I mean, I think the way that you could architect that is say our carrier rates are so aggressive, you can afford to invest in the processes, the equipment needed, the people to be able to offer that service in addition to the printing, because you're going to save so much on the carrier rates and have that spread for what you sell it to the customer, where they, a lot of screen print shops probably could.
Yeah.
They probably could.
Very interesting. Do you have any?
That is awesome.
Yeah. Do you have any insight into, you talked about doing like the freight forwarding stuff. Do you have any insight into that and how screen printing shops can get the best rates on pallets? Because I know a lot of guys doing things in bulk, they just send 3-4 pallets to a location, a state away, and a lot of them are just using like UPS Freight's public account. What is your insight into that?
I would find a freight broker that you like and trust.
Okay.
And I would just quote a couple of freight brokers. And just because a freight is a really nuanced space, and you can get hosed if you don't know what you're doing. And I would just invite two, maybe even three freight brokers to quote your LTL shipments. That if it's palletized, it's going to go LTL. And those freight brokers will have contracts with all of the major carriers, and they'll be able to run it by, you know, all the carriers have different lanes in which they're strong or where maybe they have a deficiency in their network, and they want to fill that lane with your pallets. So a freight broker can help fill those gaps for you and bring you an aggressive and competitive rate. You also have to be mindful of things like transit time, service dates to that particular area, but the freight broker can help you with that. And just having a good freight broker that you like and trust, they'll be able to save you a lot of money and help make sure that those products are delivering on.
Very cool. So this question is a little outside your expertise, but you interact with so many screen printing shops and so many brands that I'm sure you're going to have some insight. What do you think is the difference in those brands that are succeeding daily and weekly, and they actually have a reason to use you? So many people come in with perfectly fine looking art, have no idea how to market it, have no idea how to create sales. And even though they can make a finished t-shirt, just do not know how to get the revenue. So what do you think, what do you see in those business owners and brands that are succeeding with you? And what is that differentiator from somebody who's maybe making $90,000 in total sales for the entire year versus somebody who can do, you know, $10 million, $11 million in gross revenue?
I think what I see the most is somebody that has a passion into a hobby or an interest, and they build a following or an audience in that passion and then productize it with apparel or stickers or belts or backpacks. So they started with a passion about street racing, streetwear, anime, a meme, honestly, and they build a community around that and introduce products to monetize that following. And then also folks that are just savvy marketers, Mm-hmm. They understand how to create good ad campaigns. They understand who their audience is and what their audience is looking for. And then they just have controls and processes and in general organized. That's the main difference between some of the folks that we see come and go or have this big idea or this artwork that they really love that they think is going to catch on. The problem is they just don't know their audience or know how to market to their audience.
Yeah.
I love the fact that you say organized, because I think that's what I see in a lot of like folks that I know that wants to be entrepreneur or that's like early in entrepreneurship, is they have a lot of passion, lots of drive. They want to go like 5,000 miles per hour, but they are so disorganized. I think being organized as an entrepreneurship, organizing your brain and then first bring it out into the world is so, so important. I actually read a book about that because I felt like I wasn't organized enough, right? Just to like run like a big business, you have to just get yourself right. So it's an important skill to have.
Certainly. And I don't think I'm particularly organized, but we've got people on our team that are very organized that help keep the business organized. I think disciplined, organized and disciplined, they know what they're trying to achieve and they're disciplined about achieving it.
Yeah. Talking about that. So I mentioned, do you read books? What do you do as an entrepreneur to like keep yourself educated? Like what's your, where your inspiration come from?
I wish I could say I read. I don't. I do a lot of podcasts, listen to a lot of different podcasts, a lot of business-based podcasts. And then I try to surround myself with people that have been there, done that. I've got a great mentor who's about 15 years ahead of me in the experience, and I just lean on him a lot. I've got friends my age from college and high school that have started their own businesses, and I just am constantly talking with them about, hey, what are you running into? How are you handling X, Y, Z? So I'm not an avid reader. I wish I was, but I learn by doing and by failing and figuring out what works and doesn't by trial and error.
Books are for nerds.
Books are for nerds.
Books are.
My problem is I'll read a paragraph and I'll go, what did I just read? And then I have to read it over again. And the next thing you know, I've read 5 pages in 15 minutes. I'm like, oh, I'm not good at this.
Yeah. That's the next t-shirt drop is it, don't read, make money.
Yeah.
But you know what? Like, going through college, I hated reading. Like, I literally hated reading. Like, but once I started my shop, like, especially if you start your business where your network is not as big or you don't have, like, a lot of inspiration around, you got to try to find it from somewhere. And I just found, like, audiobooks to be super, like, it literally was your friend. Because, like, you could pop in an audiobook as you drive into your shop, and that kind of resonate with you throughout the whole day. So,
I'm jealous of that. I wish I had maybe my attention span just isn't strong enough to read, but I wish I did, because I think you can learn a ton from others' experiences.
Well, this is a reading intervention, so
I'm going to go to the library.
Well, as we wrap things up, could you let everyone know the best way to get a hold of your business? Also, if they do have like an upcoming drop or whatever, what should they expect in that initial conversation?
Yeah, just reach out to us. Our website is oc3pl.com. There's a contact us link in there. Madison or Ashley or Terry will respond to that inquiry. And then just be prepared to discuss with us time frame, number of pieces, SKU count, and really what you're looking to achieve. And we're happy to have a conversation, see if we can be a fit.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for your time. I think it was a great episode, and I think people are going to pull a lot out of it.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me, you guys. It's been great.
Thank you, Cole.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Please like, subscribe, and tell your mom about the podcast. We'll see you later. Bye.
That was awesome.